I fell victim to this myself, where I felt I had to be the one who always knew the answer. And so you can almost kind of make something slightly up on the spot. Like, you know enough about the database that it's not working correctly, so you slightly make something up on the spot. But me, as my more confident self, always says to the CEO or whoever now at this point, was saying like, yeah, something's going on. We're figuring it out. We don't know enough yet to say what it is. And some, you know, sometimes like very junior or pretty not really with a CEO's blow up at that answer. But the point is, that's the right answer. That right there, what I gave, was the right answer. And that's the approach that we need to take to that.
Welcome to Developing Leadership, the podcast for engineering leaders, where Isel Kent and Jason Werner share their lessons on the ins and outs of managing software teams. On today's episode, Jason and Isel explore the intersection between finance and engineering leadership and discuss the importance of position sizing in engineering orgs. From promotions to product initiatives and technology choices, leaders are constantly making bets. So the guys delve into decision-making, risk management, and the dangers of making the wrong bets. As always, this episode comes with accompanying show notes, with a deep dive into the main topics, mental models, and key moments from this episode. Find them at developingleadership.co and linked in the episode description. Developing
Leadership. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to yet another episode of Developing Leadership. Hey, Jason, how are you doing?
Good.
So, you know, right before this podcast, you and I were talking of a kind of a finance concept that I was throwing at you, which is, you know, in investing in finance, the importance of position sizing related to the risk that you're willing to take. And it kind of triggered a discussion of that. To a large extent, as engineering leaders, that's exactly what we do, right? We have, I'm kind of known for saying this dual responsibilities of an engineering, you know, build and improve your org and deliver value. And in delivering value, we're placing and sizing bets all the time. So I thought it'd be a fun one to kick us off with today.
Yeah, definitely did not resonate when we were talking about finance concepts, but as soon as we put in the engineering context, it landed well with me. So yeah, where to start? Where should we go from here?
So to me, let's start by looking at the kind of bets that we place as an engineering leader, and actually maybe even go a step earlier. Do you see engineering leaders talking about it in the using the words bets and probabilities and risk and reward? Do we even see that's part of the language, or is it just we're building X or we're building Y?
I think in organizations that have healthy overall executive management, there is this concept of risk taking and bets, and understanding too what a bet means, a positive or negative outcome from that bet too. In unhealthy orgs, it's typically a binary. So let me give a very specific example. Like, every promotion is a bet, right? Every promotion of somebody to a different role is a bet. And in healthy organizations, you're talking about, one, if they're ready, or what their strengths are, what they would bring to the role, what their weaknesses are, how they might mess up, or how things could go poorly, and how we would, you know, mitigate those sorts of things. But a negative outcome from a promotion is usually someone has to be exited from the business, but a positive outcome from that promotion is they stick and they continue to move up. But we don't tend to talk about bets as like, hey, a possible positive outcome from a negative outcome bet is that they're no longer in that role still, but they're still inside the company. And again, like, this is one of those where it gets tricky too, because like, what do you do in that situation, right? But you can understand that is actually a bet. Like, people moving to new roles are bets, and you have to understand what that would look like and what size bet you're taking too. So a person moving from, you know, tech lead to CTO of a 200 person organization is a massive, massive bet. And, you know, are you ready to take that type of an all-in position?
So we take bets on people. We obviously take bets on product initiatives, but we also take bets on technology. Now, there's the obvious ones of, you know, we're moving to the cloud or we're taking a bet on this database. But if a bet on a person goes wrong, you know, it's exit. When the bet on an initiative goes wrong, it gets killed. But it seems that when the bet on a technology goes wrong,
we just kind of live with it.
You kind of have to live with it, right?
Yeah. I mean, I had that microservices thread a long time ago on Twitter. We were talking about some of these things. And, you know, this is where I think that we don't do enough actual real company building anymore. Everything kind of has to actually be in the same kind of tried and true and situational path. So, you know, going back to an analogy I've used before on this podcast and talked about on Twitter, but the cruise ship versus the flotilla is the easiest way that I think that you, when I talk about company building, is like, hey, we're actually company building here for multiple decades, not we're company building or we're product building for a quarter. And like, I want executives to switch into that mindset, company building. And the reason why I harp on this cruise ship versus flotilla, because it allows me to take multiple bets in a safe manner. And that's the kind of the purpose of the analogy, is I can do multiple things at once inside a company and not destroy the company if I'm wrong on any one thing. And so let me give a couple of really concrete examples here. And the two most obvious and relevant would be GitHub Actions and GitHub Copilot. And GitHub Actions was started literally right after I joined GitHub. And it was a slow build on my side. I went around, I socialized this. I really pushed. I didn't know GitHub, the organization. I didn't know the people. And I was recruiting folks at the same time. And at some point, it flipped from me socializing to two very important leaders. And I've talked about them before on this podcast. Sam Lambert, who is the head of infrastructure, now runs PlanetScale. And Max Schoening, who was the head of product design at GitHub and has moved on just recently to do something else. And they took it. And they basically said, we will go and we will size this. And they did a 2-week offsite with 14 or so engineers in Tennessee, and they came back with a working prototype. So that was amazing what they did over there in that. And then GitHub Copilot was interesting, because when the Office of the CTO, which is something that we created for me to go experiment with a whole bunch of different really smart folks, started, it was outside of the normal day-to-day product engineering side of the fence. So at one point I transitioned from running product engineering and design to literally just running a very small unit of very smart folks called the Office of the CTO. And inside that, we started incubating and experimenting with a whole bunch of different ideas. So going back to that flotilla analogy, this is another very specific type of vessel that didn't adhere to the same structures as one of the cruise ships. We did our own thing. We did our own bets. We did our own way of working. Well, you know, one of the things that popped out of that was a new search beta that a lot of people are using on GitHub, but one of the more well-known ones is Copilot. And somebody who joined GitHub via acquisition, Uga Demore, who was the head of SEML, he joined Octo and said, I want to work on some AI stuff. Specifically, I want to experiment with code generation. And we ran with it. We had two really hard requirements, though. One was, we have to be able to show something in less than 3 months. And it has to be obvious that this thing is a massive big bang win. Like, we're not going for incremental here. We're going for like just something revolutionary. And he said, I think I got a couple of things that might work in this way. And with a team of less than six and less than 3 months, we had a prototype that ended up in Satya's in Microsoft board level, where unfortunately it was too good at that point. It was like, ship it. We're like, whoa, slow down here for a second. We need to actually do some more work on this. But the point being that if we try to do that inside the normal structure that was GitHub, it would have been a disastrous, like very large landmine field of all the different things. And even so we pulled it aside, it still had a bunch of fraught with peril type of situations, including bruised egos for other people who wanted to go quote unquote do this, and they thought it was inappropriate that it was being done outside. But the point being, it's like you're maximizing the success of possible. And once you're doing that, you take different structures.
So it's interesting, right? When do you pull out of all of the norms and structure of the organization? And not just when the CEO gets a crazy idea. I'm curious, Jason, like, there's for sure engineering leaders listening to this right now who are going, I want to do that with X. But what should be some of the criteria that we're applying to when we really should say, okay, we're breaking all the rules and we're going to put it somewhere else, or we're going to make it a Skunk Work project or Office of the CTO?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of very simple ones. One is when there is a singular person who's competently capable of running it, at least a singular person, maybe, you know, two in the GitHub Actions case as an example. But like, you need somebody who's like not the CTO, or if it's the CEO's harebrained idea, not the CEO. You need somebody who's in the organization who can go and do that. And this is going back to a bunch of other analogies that we use, but like, you know, a different leader that can go do that. That's one. And the other is I think you have to have time bounds. You have to understand like what would success look like, all that sort of stuff. Because, you know, one of the things that you might notice in some of the other large organizations that are quote unquote innovating, like on AI as an example now, is like they're taking multi-year approaches to some of these things. And obviously that is, there's some benefit to long research in some domains, but there shouldn't be multiple years to show some sort of value prop, some obvious value prop. I do believe too that organizations tend to need to be a little bit more mature to handle these structures, because people will get bruised ego, particularly leaders. So let's say you got a product or an engineering leader and you're moving this outside to somebody else, outside their domain, so it doesn't report into that chain. That is going to be a difficult conversation because there are going to be a bunch of bruised egos. The other flip side of this is, let's say it's staying inside of one of those two, the product or the engineering leader, if you have two people who are doing this, one of the other ones is going to be upset. And then if it's staying inside, let's say staying inside the engineering leader, because typically where this would probably stay, is then all of a sudden VPs get upset because they think they should be the one who are quote unquote doing this. And this is where I think a lot of these things fall down, is going like in a previous episode, we talked about psychologists and sociologists and stuff. Like, we do too much appeasement of these things, and we have to make sure that we understand what we're trying to achieve here. And, that's how these things fail, in my opinion.
This brings me to a tangent, which is having your favorites, right? Because it's when you're putting that project on, you are fundamentally signaling to the organization, in many cases, not all, this is one of my favorites. How do you think about that as being an engineering leader? And I don't just mean with other leaders, with engineers, up and down the organization. There's this implicit structure of who's are whose favorites, and how do you make sure that that stays healthy?
Yeah, so I mean, I will not claim that I am immune to this. I don't think anybody is ever immune to this. I have always tried to be very transparent that I make decisions based upon trust. And for me, if I'm going to choose where, like, even if it's just like I have an application engineering, data engineering, infrastructure engineering, and platform engineering as an example, and I'm going to choose where something is going to go sit, it's going to be a logical decision and a trust-based decision. And trust is, who do I think will do the best job with this? Who do I think will achieve the best outcome? All that sort of stuff. And I try to be really transparent with it. And I try to be approachable and someone else calling me on my BS as well. But at the end of the day, that's what I'm effectively, like, you're effectively trying to go do, is you're saying, I'm handing this off to somebody else. I trust this person to go do this. And the flip side of saying like, hey, I trust this person to go do this could be, I trust this other person much less to go do this. What I'm really trying to say is that if you really want to be in that position in the future, it's all about building trust now. And how do you build trust with that person is, you know, obviously each person is contextually different too. But one of the very first things I ever did when I got to GitHub was I talked about my own way of operating and what matters to me and, you know, how to build trust with me. And I was trying to be very consistent and very approachable on that as well. But the consistency in building that trust, and you don't build trust by asking for a new project. You build trust with the previous year of operating excellence and things of that nature.
I really like this. And I think this is an incredibly powerful communication tool of, there's these logical conclusions that I came to for this decision, but there's also the factor of trust and someone has built it with me. You mentioned your own way of operating. I'm a huge fan of leaders sharing their operating manual, right? Going and publishing a document that says, this is how I operate. I'm kind of curious if you could, you know, walk our listeners who haven't heard this concept before through what's a personal operating manual and what are kind of the sections that should be in it. And if you don't have it yet, you know, I highly recommend people to write one and share it with your team and fellow leaders.
Oh, so it's not something I've ever done in explicit ways and shared with the organization. But what I have done is I've talked about what's important to me with my leaders and with the org. So it's not something I published. So, but for those that aren't familiar, as I so mentioned, it's usually a concept of like almost writing your own CV, but it's like, hey, these are what matters to me, my inputs and the outputs that matter to me. I respond well to this, I don't respond well to that. You know, my preferred written communications or my preferred communication style is X, Y, or Z, or my, you know, that sort of stuff. There's a lot of different ways and sections that can go into this. And maybe we can actually link to a couple in the show notes to give people an idea. What I have done at each level and each role that I've had in the past, though, is I said how I want to view like the next couple of years. And I work backwards. And then I say, here's basically my API, which is effectively what we're talking about here. And so let me give you an example of how I've had this conversation with folks. And it occurs in group settings, all hands, even if I'm being challenged on something or asked a question, but very often in one-on-ones, because you're trying to, something, right? With an organization. And the root of all leadership, in my opinion, is achieving outcome that wouldn't exist via other people. And the best way to do that is to start talking about expectations and all that sort of stuff. And also like how the interfaces work and things of that nature. So what I've said before is the easiest way, particularly let's orient this around senior leaders for a moment, because it's much easier to talk about folks who are experienced and at the very high end of the spectrum and been doing this for a while. The easiest way to talk about my own interface is at trust, because trust is the root of everything. And trust is the one that happens to be easiest to break too. And so ways in which trust is built, you said you're going to do something, you did it. Your organization is well taken care of, compensated well, happy. I don't end up hearing about your organization except in the positive ways. When people talk about your organization, they generally love it. When people talk about your organization in other organizations, they have positive experiences. Going back to you do what you say, like literally, like you own your area. You're a professional. If you don't know something, you say, I don't know, but I will go find out. You don't ask me 1,000 questions. You can ask me 1 or 2 as an orientation question, but you then go do the rest. Trust is, and how is trust lost? For me, it's simple Machiavellian type of things. Like you're pitting one group against another group. It's you, going back to the Eleanor Roosevelt quote, the great talk about ideas, the average talk about people, or events, the small talk about people.
Exactly.
Constantly talking about people on a regular basis. It's like, you can see the meter. Like that is not what I'm about. It actually lowers my energy, and it really drives me into a negative space with a person really quickly. And
trust the first thing you fire on. To me, breaking trust once it's below a level is the fastest way and easiest.
I don't think I've ever fired faster than when someone has broken trust, and it's always been about some sort of undermining Machiavellian thing. Like there's been multiple times where someone has thought they should have my job or something like that. And I've actually put up with some of those situations because I thought I was coaching a person, but I've never fired faster than when it was them trying to undermine a peer and take over a peer's thing. And it wasn't with me, because I shut that shit down. It was with somebody else inside the organization. And then somebody else comes to me and says, yeah, I heard that, John is not doing well from this person over here. Like, you're like, I'm going to fire that person. That person is about to go. And they're like, I heard they're doing really well. I'm like, you just got played. That shit's going
to
go away.
And I think, to be honest, that's very practical advice for anyone listening to this. If you're seeing that in your organization, it is the quickest spiral to a terrible culture. And I think it's any, good leader's responsibility to try to snuff that out as quickly as possible. How do you discover that? Besides actually picking up on the Machiavellian techniques that are coming to you.
So a couple of things that are very useful for me. One is there's a set of people who want to show that they have information, because information is a commodity in Silicon Valley and high-tech startups. If you are confident in yourself, you can sit with knowing way more than people think you know and just let more information come to you. So part of that is not having to say, I know a thing. So if you know somebody's having a conversation with somebody else, you don't necessarily need to tip your hand that you know. You can just like watch it and see what happens, and or even have a conversation directly with that person and not confront them right away, but kind of ask questions and see what happens and all that sort of stuff. The other is all senior leaders need to have good relationships with other senior leaders and other folks inside the organization. And I go back to my canary example about how the organization is running and how things are going for people on the ground, but also like other execs and, hey, what's going on, all that sort of stuff, like, et cetera, et cetera. But you'll hear more in those situations from others than not. Now, you're not going to hear everything, but you've got to look for signals. So like, as an example, if somebody is quote unquote going to, another organization and talking shit about somebody else in the group, you may not hear from that person direct, but they'll hear 3 people removed. And they're like, yeah, I heard about that. And it, by that point, it's wrong. That's not exactly what happened, but it's signal. It's the smoke, fire analogy type of deal. And so when you hear stuff like that, you do listen to it. Now, your job is not to act on that right away. Your job is to confirm or see if there's more signal or all that sort of stuff. And it's never to react to it. But sometimes you get a direct line. And when you get a direct line, that's when you know, hey, let's go tease this out a little bit more.
You mentioned sitting with more knowledge than might be obvious to the room, right? The kind of power of not having to always show what you know and asking questions. Do you think we ask enough questions as engineering leaders today?
I mean, typically, probably not. No. My personal style of leadership is to typically ask more questions. We've had this actual conversation about when you flip from like more directive to more kind of coaching-ish type of approach. And I like to coach more than I like to be super directive. But I think you need to be directive. But I think many people are actually more directive and they need to learn to coach more.
But isn't there a whole category of questions that wouldn't fall in between the directive and coaching part?
I do believe.
The gathering of understanding the complex system with which you're in.
Oh, totally. And so one of my classic examples here that I give, and I think we actually talked about this on the podcast, so I keep, we've done a lot of episodes, can't remember what is the podcast versus what is not. But one of them is, my favorite thing is when an engineer typically says, that's impossible to do. Well, my job is not to tell them how it is possible to do that. My job is to start asking questions to demystify whether or not for them to almost come to the conclusion. So it's a simple way to frame this, but hey, that's not possible. Well, if it was possible, how would it get done? And next thing you know, the engineer is rattling off a series of things that need to go right or blah, blah, blah. And you're like, well, okay, cool. That's the start of a plan. Let's start asking more questions along the way and see what comes of it. But like the point is it's gone from the area of not possible to possible, but expensive, or possible, but long time, or possible but risky. And great, that's the start of this. But that's an example of where I think we as engineering leaders get it really wrong. And I think VCs tend to get this really wrong, and exec leaders with engineers tend to get this really wrong. And I think non-technical CEOs get this really wrong with CTOs and VPs of engineering. So a good example here would be CEO asks the VP of engineering or a CTO a question, and the VP, and they expect the CTO to know the answer, the exact answer. Hey, we're having scaling issues. We're having some outages, et cetera, et cetera. What do we do? And the CTO should never say, if it's an in the moment type of thing, like have every single answer in there. Like, but there's this expectation because they're technical, they should be the most technical and the most knowledgeable about the entire system. And there's this, that sort of thing. That's a 5-person org behavior. That doesn't work at a 500 or 1,000 or 2,000 person org behavior. The role of the CTO in that situation is to go into the room and be like, we got this problem. What are we doing about it? What are the database constructs? What are the eventing structures? How are we doing this? Like all that sort of, that is the role in that moment. And then the role, if we're talking about this as an important type of thing, which it is, and the CTO should be owning a lot of this, is to go and talk about the expectations about now versus the future and how we're going to get out of problems and how we're not going to get into problems. More importantly, how we're going to avoid these types of things in the future and stuff. But there's this, in particular, like I fell victim to this myself, where I felt I had to be the one who always knew the answer. And so you can almost kind of make something slightly up on the spot. Like, enough about the database that it's not working correctly. So you slightly make something up on the spot. But me, as my more confident self, always says to the CEO or whoever now at this point was saying like, yeah, something's going on. We're figuring it out. We don't know enough yet to say what it is. And sometimes like very junior or pretty not really with a CEO's blow up at that answer. But the point is, that's the right answer. That right there, what I gave was the right answer. And that's the approach that we need to take to that.
And we like it. So to kind of loop that back to where we started today on placing bets and which bets to place. When we're sitting around as engineering leaders and or even just with ourselves, how many bets should be top of mind for us at any given moment?
Well, that's a tough one. I think obviously as the organization gets larger, I think you need to be placing more bets. And as the organization is smaller, maybe not, maybe the total number doesn't necessarily change, but the size of the bets probably change a little bit. Like at some point, you're a 5-person organization, you're not betting the company on a major bet. Maybe you are, maybe the entire company is being based upon one product decision that you're trying to go after, but that's like intimately involved with the CEO and all that sort of stuff. But I do think that you should be making micro and macro bets a lot. And one of the common strategies of the Office of the CTO that we talked about, I talked about with my group, and Copilot and the search are a really good example of this. It's a simple business parlance of Horizon 1, Horizon 2, and Horizon 3. And I want us to focus on Horizon 3 efforts, which I defined as more than 18 months out. And if we took on 10 of them, 8 of them were not going to see the light of day. 2 of them were going to be massively successful, like company-changing bets. And I think we hit more than the 2 out of 10, which to me was an indication, one, we probably didn't think even big enough, possibly. You know, we hit a bunch of really good things out of the park there. 2, I think it was also probably too close. I was still too in the moment of the roadmap of GitHub, et cetera, et cetera. But the point being, I think you need to be placing multiples. I think if you're Microsoft size, or let's take Google, because I think Microsoft has been doing better at this. If you're Google sized, you need to be running like AI bets everywhere, not like concentrated in one company, like which I think unfortunately they've oriented themselves around with DeepMind and a couple of things. Like you've got to be saying like, hey, what are we doing in all these different areas? Like, how are we experimenting with this? What does the future of the operating system look like? What does the future of YouTube look like? What is the future of this? And like, not just like at the macro level even too, it's like, hey, are we experimenting with some element of these things? And I don't know each one of those business lines well enough to pontificate on it, but the point being that people should be making bets. And the way Google is structured right now too, with CEOs in each one of those business lines, if those CEOs aren't thinking that way, well, you know, they're already a couple of years behind.
So I want to take this on when to know if a macro trend means we have to bet. Right? If we look over the last years, there have been quite a few macro trends that you and I remember looking at and said like, oh my God, there's going to be a whole bunch of bets being placed on this now because they were either too early or because they don't make sense. And like the classic example is, you know, the big bank enterprise all of a sudden, you know, going deep on placing a big bet on VR, you know, way too early. Or, I mean, the blockchain and Web3 space has had many of these. But then right now we're in a place where all of a sudden we look at, you know, the importance of large language models. And probably you and I can agree that that means everyone should be placing bets yesterday. So I'm kind of curious of, or what's the thought process that you and I use, and not making us oracles, but in discerning when it is we should be placing bets on a macro trend and when we should be ignoring a macro trend. Because I think the ignoring part is even harder for some execs when everyone around them is doing the latest, you know, X, Y, or Z.
So ignoring, I think, is the hardest thing to go do. Because, I mean, think about just the FOMO people have with crypto, right? Yeah. And opting into this. And let's actually talk about Meta here real quickly, yeah, because this is an interesting one. So Meta effectively, I mean, they bet the business on ARVR, right? They're betting, yeah, the entire business on this. And who am I to criticize and critique Zuck here, given his success? But let me just say that, holy cow, like, you could talk about conviction a lot, or you can talk just about risk. And there was 100 ways in which this could have gone much better for Meta in a less risky way. And maybe, I don't know the internal workings of Zuck's mind or the way that they were thinking about this, but, and maybe Facebook was in a deeper death spiral than we ever could have imagined from the outside. But this is a Rubicon, burn the boats type of bet, and it could have been mitigated in, again, 100 different ways that could have de-risked this while still keeping the cash cow alive, including keeping the cash cow alive and allowing him to go into this next wave of AI large language model bets, where they were positioned in such a way that they could have done things that nobody else could have done. But, you know, that's one way in which they, you know, let's just say, so that is a decision, that is for sure.
And again, I don't know Meta well enough, but my opinion has changed here over the years. I was the first person in the last years to probably look at that and say exactly the same thing that you're saying right now. On the other hand, if you look at true cash cow businesses, and Meta being one of them, and I think they're a good business should be one that generates a lot of excess cash, right? I think, like, fundamentally, you know, when a lot of us are in companies where we don't generate excess cash, that's a historical temporal anomaly that, like, you know, that should correct itself, right? It's either betting early on the future, but fundamentally, you know, all of recorded economic history for a company to become a multi-decade company, and you said that, you know, that phrase earlier, they have to be able to make cash, right? And so Meta, I think, roughly will invest in AR a quarter's worth of operating cash flow, right? I don't know if the exact number, I don't know their business well enough, but it's essentially saying 25% of the extra cash that we make, we're investing year in and year out on the future. Now, I think the interesting thing is that I don't think you and I would argue about the fact that AR is the extremely likely in our foreseeable future. I don't know if it's 1, 5, or 10 years, 15 years, I couldn't predict this, but it is an extremely likely, you know, mobile-like event that will happen, right? iPhone-like bringing-like event, right?
I don't disagree. What I disagree with Meta's approach here is I feel that their approach was the riskiest possible approach, which is the rebranding of the company, the rebranding of the structure, the all-in on this, when in fact, it would be the equivalent of decommissioning OS X to all in an iPhone, in my opinion, and rebranding the company from Apple to something else. I actually don't disagree with the decision, and I'm not one of those who thinks AR and VR and this is a fool's folly. I think it's just maybe, and Zuck might go down in history as someone who like saw something sooner, and I think he will with AR VR. I do actually believe in it, but the way in which it was done to me indicates either I don't understand the business of Facebook, maybe it was worse off than it was, or something else fundamentally about Facebook that only Zuck knew is going on. Because I feel, again, like the AR VR, this approach would have been de-risked from a public perception, which is important for stock price, public perception. And remember, they did how many billions of stock buyback over the last 2 years, which now look like a black hole in the balance sheet because of the stock price crater, which eventually could work out really well still. But if they had, instead of taking the entire company and pivoting, which I don't think they took the entire company, but they took some massive portion of it, they took 500 people, 200 people to start or whatever it was, and really ramped this up at speed and really showed these examples. Because now they're going to get dragged every time those avatars don't have legs. Like when they celebrate, the avatars have legs and stuff like this. And again, I'm not going back to the long-term strategic. I'm going to the short-term in the stock at the moment because I feel that is something that is going to harm them here. Now, again, I think they could have been right, but I think that they took the riskiest possible approach.
But it's you know, if I pull us back into the engineering leadership realm, because if we go down this, I think we'll have a whole other episode. There are moments where betting the farm are incredibly important, or there are moments where you have to outsize communicate in your organization to make change happen. So independent of and Facebook didn't really bet the farm, but like you said, rebranding, you know, communicating. How do you look at that? If we bring that to like a smaller scale and inside an engineering organization, when is it the engineering leader's role to go into full, let's call it, you know, rebranding? This is where we're placing a bet mode. And how important is communication in this, right? Because when you're putting that team together of seven people that's working on something in the office of the CTO, is very, very different type of bet than when you're making a bet that you need to socialize across the entire organization. And what bets can an engineering leader socialize that don't come from the CEO or playing that role?
I think the technical ones, obviously, like languages and frameworks and, you know, tech stacks and things of that nature. But even that usually has to be in conjunction with senior leadership, cloud movements or all that sort of stuff. And this to me is, again, where I think like engineering leaders, It's difficult for me to say when you want all in on something, because the problem with all inning on any one thing from a technology perspective is that the technology can then take down an otherwise healthy business. And that's an area you never want to be in, because an otherwise healthy business that is brought down by technology is the worst possible scenario, obviously for an engineering leader, but for a company, because you had something that is honestly very rare. A working business that is generating free cash flow and all that sort of stuff is rare, and to be taken down from the inside by technology and some missteps like that is just, it's tragic. So I do think that they can socialize going all in on cloud and those sorts of decisions and those sorts of ones where it's that type of thing. I think it's
but the flip side of this is everything that happened in mobile, right? Like over a decade ago.
I don't think most people all in on mobile. I think most people still said, hey, we're going to have our business and mobile. Yeah.
No, I mean the actual mobile companies, right? I mean the actual Blackberries and the Nokias of the world, the ones whose names we barely remember, right? Like we all look back and say, oh, they should have gone all in on.
This to me is going back to the Meta example. So yeah. BlackBerry, it's existential. That's when you all in at a company level, it's existential. And like whenever I use that word on Twitter, that's what I mean. It's like this company might not exist in its current form, fashion, function, or at all in a decade if we don't radically do something. And to me, that's when I go back to like I'm making this Meta analogy. It's like I might not fundamentally understand something about the Facebook business because that's what it looks like Zuck is actually doing. And I'm not gonna second guess that portion of it because I don't understand that, because we do have the examples of BlackBerry.
Yeah.
And there was a moment in time still when BlackBerry looked like it might be able to navigate that situation, but by iPhone 2, but by for sure by 3, it couldn't.
Yeah.
But it still didn't change. And obviously it's out of business now. Well, I mean, it's still around, but you know what I mean? No one gives a shit about BlackBerry.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't even know they were still around. So I want to kind of bring a final point into this. So Jason, one of the things, you know, when we talk about existential, we think of the BlackBerries and the Facebooks of the world. And I've heard you over several episodes over time, you know, mention multi-decade decision-making, multi-decade horizons. There are extremely few software companies that ever make it to be multi-decade.
Yeah.
Right. Like the vast majority of companies today that are a business are going to be fundamentally gone. And it's to me radically different of businesses in the real world, right? Like a chip manufacturer or a consumer brand. I mean, consumer brands probably a little bit more, but there's a lot more examples of businesses that are able to sustain multi-decades. And well, tech is young, so we won't have a 100-year business, but it's extremely rare. And it almost feels that a lot of that is because of technical decisions we make.
So this is a long topic for me because this goes back to company building and being very strategic over time. And, you know, a good example, like let's talk about Microsoft and Oracle, right? I don't know how old Oracle is, but Microsoft is now one of the most valuable companies in the world. It survived the bomber era. It's become this. Oracle is largely irrelevant. It still has a good book of business and stuff, but as far as like we think about as like generational companies, it's largely irrelevant. But it's still here. It's still around. You know, it's still in business and it still employs a ton of people. At the root of it, I think this goes to like, yeah, you can't make, like if you're a 5-person company and you have the hubris to talk about being a 100-year company and all that sort of stuff, like you kind of love it, but at the same time, you haven't earned the right to exist yet. You got to make it to year 2, yep, then to year 5, and then to year 10. You got to make $100 million. Well, you got to make $1 million, then you got to make $10 million, then you got to make $100 million. You got to do all that sort of stuff. That's like the hard work. At some point, you earn the right to start talking about being a decade long company or a multi-decade long company or a generational company. And of the things that will hold all of those companies back, it's a finite set. And I talk about the finite set of all things in tech in general as being like 4 fundamental things. One is ideas, one is time, one is, you know, people, and one is money. And so if you're a business that can make money, can attract people, uses time efficiently, and has a bunch of ideas, that's at the root of this. But let's talk about building one of those and what will take down a company. People, or lack of people to build this thing, is, as far as I'm concerned, one of the biggest. And I mean like turnover. Like let's talk like again about Gates to Ballmer, the Gates to Ballmer turnover. It almost killed Microsoft. Technical decisions. Microsoft's still fighting technical decisions on what an operating system was going to look like. And you know, it's kind of working its way out, but it's taken them how long before Windows went from basically garbage to okay-ish today, but it's still nothing compared to what, you know, OS X is in terms of like an everyday machine and for the most regard. But so
I like how both of you and I say this, but when's the last time you actually used Windows? Because I
have. Oh, I actually use it on a daily basis.
I actually use it on a daily basis.
Okay, I do. So okay. I'm one of those people that uses all the operating systems. I have my Linux machine, my Mac, and my Windows machine over here. And my son, so this is actually something I get really upset about too, because my son, Hayo, mentioned it's on the spectrum. He uses Windows because it's for whatever reason, like his schoolwork and all that sort of stuff. And he comes to me on a daily basis and I start seeing the real edges in Windows and like where it is and stuff. And like, you know, it's my gaming PC and one of my specific development tools I use over here on this one. But I start to see the way in which it shows its age and really has not been really thought of and cared for. So I get a little annoyed. This is like a personal pet peeve of mine. I get a little annoyed on this one, but I also understand why it is the way it is. I understand why, because it's a 40-year-old operating or 30-year-old operating system or whatever it is, and it has all this cruft and has all these legacy decisions, but ultimately it can take it down, right? Like, you know, look at Microsoft's business. Look at the totality of Microsoft's business. And if you got Xbox Live, you got Azure, you got Windows, you've got now with all this AI stuff, you got Office, all that. If you think about the strategic nature of what the operating system could have been in that. And yes, Azure started out as Windows Server, but it couldn't have been Windows Server. It made up fundamentally a whole host of wrong decisions for that type of business. Imagine how strategic it would be. And this goes again to another topic that we've talked about in the past. The company is successful. Imagine how much more successful it could have been with better technical decisions. So ultimately, I think people and technology are the ones that will stop all companies from becoming generational companies. And the technology is the one that hold it back and basically say, we got to take care of this legacy business effectively. And we got to keep it running. We got to do that. It's a cash cow. We got to keep it going, but we fundamentally can't really change it. It's too risky, et cetera, et cetera. And then not having people that can either bring new business lines, so they lose the innovative nature of them, or augment business lines in new and creative ways. And then what happens, I think, is to become that company that persists, you become a more Salesforce-ish and Microsoft-ish to a degree, where you start acquiring all the innovative companies. So you need to be generating a shit ton of cash, because you got to buy, your stock has to be valuable, and you have to be sitting on a war chest.
And to close the loop, that's what Facebook did incredibly well, more than anyone else.
Yep. So those three companies that we just mentioned, Salesforce, Microsoft, and Facebook, they're like the premier in that space. They generated so much money. Their stock was so valuable. They used that to basically buy every competitor or buy every innovative thing or buy whatever, and they augmented their businesses. They would look fundamentally different if they never went on those acquisition sprees.
I think that's a fantastic place to leave today on. We started with bets on people, ended with bets on buying companies, and hopefully shared a bit with you guys on how to strategically think about them. Thanks, Jason. This was a good one.
This is good.
Thank you for listening to Developing Leadership. Make sure you subscribe to follow us on our journey to more meaningful engineering leadership. If you have any challenges or topics you would like us to explore in an upcoming episode, tweet or DM us at devleadership_. To learn more about data-enabled engineering and how metrics can help your teams and improve your processes, go to athenian.com. See you in 2 weeks for another episode of Developing Leadership.